And you answered him. That makes me the fool Isabel calls me, doesn't it? You are no fool, Vianne. She gazed at Vianne. And your sister is quick to judge. That much I remember about her. I ask myself if they would have found these names without my help. They have dismissed Jews from positions all over town. Do you not know this? Monsieur Penoir is not the postmaster anymore, and Judge Breillat has been replaced. I have had news from Paris that the headmistress of College Sevigny was forced to resign, as have all of the Jewish singers at the Paris Opera. Perhaps they needed your help, perhaps they did not. Certainly they would have found the names without your help, Mother said in a voice that was both gentle and stern. But that is not what matters. What do you mean? I think as this war goes on, we will all have to look more deeply. These questions are not about them, but about us. Vianne felt tears sting her eyes.
I don't know what to do anymore. Antoine always took care of everything. The Wehrmacht and the Gestapo are more than I can handle.
Don't think about who they are. Think about who you are and what sacrifices you can live with and what will break you.
It's all breaking me. I need to be more like Isabel. She is so certain of everything. This war is black and white for her. Nothing seems to scare her.
Isabel will have her crisis of faith in this too, as will we all. I have been here before in the Great War. I know the hardships are just beginning. You must stay strong.
By believing in God.
Yes, of course, but not only by believing in God. Prayers and faith will not be enough, I'm afraid. The path of righteousness is often dangerous. Get ready, Vianne. This is only your first test. Learn from it. Mother leaned forward and hugged Vianne again. Vianne held on tightly, her face pressed to the scratchy wool habit. When she pulled back, she felt a little better. Mother Superior stood, took Vianne's hand, and drew her to a stand. Perhaps you could find the time to visit the children this week and give them a lesson? They loved it when you taught them painting. As you can imagine, there's a lot of grumbling about empty bellies these days. Praise the Lord, the sisters have an excellent garden and the goat's milk and cheese is a godsend. Still...
Yes, Vianne said.
Everyone knew about how the belt tightening felt, especially to children. You're not alone, and you're not the one in charge, Mother said gently. Ask for help when you need it, and give help when you can. I think that is how we serve God, and each other, and ourselves, in times as dark as these.
You're not the one in charge.
Vianne contemplated Mother's words all the way home. She had always taken great comfort in her faith. When Maman had first begun to cough, and then when that coughing deepened into a hacking shudder that left sprays of blood on handkerchiefs, Vianne had prayed to God for all that she needed. Help, guidance, a way to cheat the death that had come to call. At 14, she'd promised God anything, everything, if he would just spare her Maman's life. With her prayers unanswered, she returned to God and prayed for the strength to deal with the aftermath. Her loneliness, Papa's bleak, angry silences and drunken rages, Isabel's wailing neediness. Time and again, she had returned to God, pleading for help, promising her faith. She wanted to believe that she was neither alone nor in charge, but rather that her life was unfolding according to his plan, even if she couldn't see it. Now, though, such hope felt as slight and bendable as tin. She was alone, and there was no one else in charge, no one but the Nazis. She had made a terrible, grievous mistake. She couldn't take it back, however much she might hope for such a chance. She couldn't undo it. but a good woman would accept responsibility and blame and apologize. Whatever else she was or wasn't, whatever her failings, she intended to be a good woman. And so she knew what she needed to do. She knew it. And still, when she came to the gate at Rachel's cottage, she found herself unable to move. Her feet felt heavy, her heart even more so. She took a deep breath and knocked on the door. There was a shuffling of feet within, and then the door opened. Rachel held her sleeping son in one arm and had a pair of dungarees slung over the other.
"Vian," she said, smiling. "Come in."
Vian almost gave in to cowardice.
"Oh, Rachel, I just stopped by to say hello."
Instead, she took a deep breath and followed her friend into the house. She took her usual place in the comfortable upholstered chair tucked in close to the blazing fire.
"Take Ari, I'll make us coffee."
Vian reached for the sleeping baby and took him in her arms. He snuggled close, and she stroked his back and kissed the back of his head.
"We heard that some of the care packages were being delivered to prisoner of war camps by the Red Cross,"
Rachel said a moment later, coming into the room carrying two cups of coffee. She set one down on the table next to Vian.
"Where are the girls?"
"At my house, with Isabel. Probably learning how to shoot a gun."
Rachel laughed.
"There are worse skills to have."
She pulled the dungarees from her shoulder and tossed them onto a straw basket with the rest of her sewing. Then she sat down across from Vian. Vian breathed in deeply of the sweet scent that was pure baby. When she looked up, Rachel was staring at her.
"Is it one of those days?"
she asked quietly. Vian gave an unsteady smile. Rachel knew how much Vian sometimes mourned her lost babies, and how deeply she'd prayed for more children. It had been difficult between them, not a lot, but a little, when Rachel had gotten pregnant with Ari. There was joy for Rachel, and a thread of envy.
"No," she said. She lifted her chin slowly, looked her best friend in the eyes. "I have something to tell you."
"What?"
Vian drew in a breath.
"Do you remember the day we wrote the postcards, and Captain Beck was waiting for me when we got home?"
I offered to come in with you."
"I wish you had, although I don't suppose it would have made a difference. He just would have waited until you left."
Rachel started to rise.
"Did he?"
No, she said quickly. "Not that. He was working at the dining room table that day, writing something when I returned. He asked me for a list of names. He wanted to know which of the teachers at the school were Jewish or communists."
She paused.
"He asked about homosexuals and Freemasons, too, as if people talk about such things. You told him you didn't know."
Shame made Vian look away, but only for a second. She forced herself to say,
"I gave him your name, Rachel, along with the others."
Rachel went very still. The color drained from her face, making her dark eyes stand out.
"And they fired us."
Vian swallowed hard, nodded. Rachel got to her feet and walked past Vian without stopping, ignoring her pleading,
"Please, Rachel,"
pulling away so she couldn't be touched. She went into her bedroom and slammed the door shut. Time passed slowly, in indrawn breaths, and captured prayers, and creaks of the chair. Vian watched the tiny black hands on the mantel clock tick forward. She patted the baby's back in rhythm with the passing minutes. Finally, the door opened. Rachel walked back into the room. Her hair was a mess, as if she'd been shoving her hands through it. Her cheeks were blotchy, from either anxiety or anger, maybe both. Her eyes were red from crying.
"I'm so sorry," Vian said, rising. "Forgive me."
Rachel came to a stop in front of her, looking down at her. Anger flashed in her eyes, then faded and was replaced by resignation.
Everyone in town knows I'm a Jew, Vian. I've always been proud of it.
I know that. It's what I told myself. Still, I shouldn't have helped him. I am sorry. I wouldn't hurt you for the world. I hope you know that.
Of course I know it, Rachel said quietly. But, V, you need to be more careful. I know Beck is young and handsome and friendly and polite. But he's a Nazi, and they are dangerous.
The winter of 1940 was the coldest anyone could remember. Snow fell day after day, blanketing the trees and fields. Icicles glittered on drooping tree branches. And still, Isabel woke every Friday morning, hours before dawn, and distributed her terrorist papers, as the Nazis now called them. Last week's tract followed the military operations in North Africa and alerted the French people to the fact that the winter's food shortages were not a result of the British blockades, as Nazi propaganda insisted, but rather were caused by the Germans looting everything France produced. Isabel had been distributing these tracts for months now, and truthfully, she couldn't see that they were having much impact on the people of Karivaux. Many of the villagers still supported Pétain. Even more didn't care. A disturbing number of her neighbors looked upon the Germans and thought, so young, just boys, and went on trudging through life with their heads down, just trying to stay out of danger. The Nazis had noticed the flyers, of course. Some Frenchmen and women would use any excuse to curry favor, and giving the Nazis the flyers they found in their letterboxes was a start. Isabel knew that the Germans were looking for whoever printed and distributed the tracts, but they weren't looking too hard, especially not on these snowy days when the Blitz of London was all anyone could talk about. Perhaps the Germans knew that words on a piece of paper were not enough to turn the tide of a war. Today, Isabel lay in bed, with Sophie curled like a tiny sword fern beside her, and Vian sleeping heavily on the girl's other side. The three of them now slept together in Vian's bed. Over the past month, they'd added every quilt and blanket they could find to the bed. Isabel lay watching her breath gather and disappear in thin white clouds. She knew how cold the floor would be even through the woolen stocking she wore to bed. She knew this was the last time all day she would be warm. She steeled herself and eased out from underneath the pile of quilts. Beside her, Sophie made a moaning sound and rolled over to her mother's body for heat. When Isabel's feet hit the floor, pain shot into her shins. She winced and hobbled out of the room. The stairs took forever. Her feet hurt so badly. The damn chilblains. Everyone was suffering from them this winter. Supposedly, it was from a lack of butter and fat, but Isabel knew it was caused by cold weather and socks full of holes and shoes that were coming apart at the seams. She wanted to start a fire, ached for even a moment's warmth, really, but they were on their last bit of wood. In late January, they'd started ripping out barn wood and burning it, along with toolboxes and old chairs and whatever else they could find. She made herself a cup of boiling water and drank it down, letting the heat and weight trick her stomach into thinking it wasn't empty. She ate a small bit of stale bread, wrapped her body in a layer of newsprint, and then put on Antoine's coat and her own mittens and boots. A woolen scarf she wrapped around her head and neck, and even so, when she stepped outside, the cold took her breath away. She closed the door behind her and trudged out into the snow, her chilblained toes throbbing with every step, her fingers going cold instantly, even inside the mittens. It was eerily quiet out here. She hiked through the knee-deep snow and opened the broken gate and stepped out onto the white-packed road. Because of the cold and snow, it took her 3 hours to deliver her papers. This week's content was about the Blitz. The Boche had dropped 32,000 bombs on London in one night alone. Dawn, when it came, was as weak as meatless broth. She was the first in line at the butcher's shop, but others soon followed. At 7 a.m., the butcher's wife rolled open the window gate and unlocked the door.
"Octopus," the woman said.
Isabel felt a pang of disappointment.
"No meat?"
"Not for the French, mademoiselle."
She heard grumbling behind her from the women who wanted meat, and farther back, from the women who knew they wouldn't even be lucky enough to get octopus. Isabel took the paper-wrapped octopus and left the shop. At least she'd gotten something. There was no tinned milk to be had anymore, not with ration cards or even on the black market. She was fortunate enough to get a little camembert after 2 more hours in line. She covered her precious items with the heavy towel in her basket and hobbled down Rue Victor Hugo. As she passed a café, filled with German soldiers and French policemen, she smelled brewed coffee and freshly baked croissants, and her stomach grumbled.
"Mademoiselle?"
A French policeman nodded crisply and indicated a need to step around her. She moved aside and watched him put up a poster in an abandoned storefront's window. The first poster read, "Notice. Shot for spying. The Jew Jacob Mansard, the communist Victor Yablonsky, and the Jew Louis Devry." And the second, "Notice. Henceforth, all French people arrested for any crime or infraction will be considered hostages. When a hostile act against Germany occurs in France, hostages will be shot."
"They're shooting ordinary French people for nothing?" she said.
"Don't look so pale, mademoiselle. These warnings are not for beautiful women such as yourself."
Isabel glared at the man. He was worse than the Germans. A Frenchman doing this to his own people. This was why she hated the Vichy government. What good was self-rule for half of France if it turned them into Nazi puppets?
"Are you unwell, mademoiselle?"
So solicitous, so caring. What would he do if she called him a traitor and spat in his face?
"I am fine, merci."
She watched him cross the street confidently, his back straight, his hat positioned just so on his cropped brown hair. The German soldiers in the café welcomed him warmly, clapped him on the back, and pulled him into their midst. Isabel turned away in disgust. That was when she saw it. A bright silver bicycle leaning against the side wall of the café. At the sight of it, she thought how much it would change her life, ease her pain, to ride to town and back each day. Normally a bicycle would be guarded by the soldiers in the café, but on this dark, snow-dusted morning, no one was outside at a table.
"Don't do it."
Her heart started beating, quickly. Her palms turned damp and hot within her mittens. She glanced around. The women queued up at the butcher's made it a point to see nothing and make eye contact with no one. The windows of the café across the street were fogged. Inside, the men were olive-hued silhouettes. So certain of themselves. "Of us," she thought bitterly. At that, whatever sliver of restraint she possessed disappeared. She held the basket close to her side and limped out onto the ice-slicked cobblestone street. From that second, that one step forward, the world seemed to blur around her and time slowed down. She heard her breath, saw the plumes of it in front of her face. The buildings blurred or faded into white hulks, the snow dazzled, until all she could see was the glint of the silver handlebars and the 2 black tires. She knew there was only one way to do this, fast, without a glance sideways or a pause in her step. Somewhere a dog barked. A door banged shut. Isabel kept walking. 5 steps separated her from the bicycle. 4, 3, 2. She stepped up onto the sidewalk and took hold of the bicycle and jumped onto it. She rode down the cobblestone street, the chassis clanging at bumps in the road. She skidded around the corner, almost fell, and righted herself, pedaling hard toward Rue La Grande. There, she turned into the alley and jumped off the bicycle to knock on the door. 4 hard clacks. The door opened slowly. Henri saw her and frowned. She pushed her way inside. The small meeting room was barely lit. A single oil lamp sat on a scarred wooden table. Henri was the only one here. He was making sausage from a tray of meat and fat. Skeins of it hung from hooks on the wall. The room smelled of meat and blood and cigarette smoke. She yanked the bicycle in with her and slammed the door shut.
"Well, hello," he said, wiping his hands on a towel. "Have we called a meeting I don't know about?"
"No."
He glanced at her side.
"That's not your bicycle."
"I stole it," she said, "from right under their noses."
"It is, or was, Alain Deschamps' bicycle. He left everything and fled to Lyon with his family when the occupation began."
He moved toward her.
"Lately I have been seeing an SS soldier riding it around town."
"SS?"
Isabel's elation faded. There were ugly rumors swirling about the SS and their cruelty. Perhaps she should have thought this through. He moved closer, so close she could feel the warmth of his body. She had never been alone with him before, nor so near him. She saw for the first time that his eyes were neither brown nor green, but rather a hazel gray that made her think of fog in a deep forest. She saw a small scar at his brow that had either been a terrible gash at one time or poorly stitched, and it made her wonder all at once what kind of life he'd led that had brought him here and to communism. He was older than she by at least a decade, although, to be honest, he seemed even older sometimes, as if perhaps he'd suffered a great loss.
"You'll need to paint it," he said.
"I don't have any paint."
"I do."
"Would you?"
"A kiss," he said.
"A kiss?"
She repeated it to stall for time. This was the sort of thing that she'd taken for granted before the war. Men desired her. They always had. She wanted that back, wanted to flirt with Henri and be flirted with, and yet the very idea of it felt sad and a little lost, as if perhaps kisses didn't mean much anymore, and flirtation even less.
"One kiss and I'll paint your bicycle tonight, and you can pick it up tomorrow."
She stepped toward him and tilted her face up to his. They came together easily, even with all the coats and layers of newsprint and wool between them. He took her in his arms and kissed her. For a beautiful second, she was Isabel Rossignol again, the passionate girl whom men desired. When it ended and he drew back, she felt deflated, sad. She should say something, make a joke, or perhaps pretend that she felt more than she did. That's what she would have done before, when kisses had meant more, or maybe less.
"There's someone else," Henri said, studying her intently.
"No, there isn't."
Henri touched her cheek gently.
"You're lying."
Isabel thought of all that Henri had given her. He was the one who'd brought her into the Free French Network and given her a chance. He was the one who believed in her. And yet, when he kissed her, she thought of Gaetan.
"He didn't want me," she said.
It was the first time she'd told anyone the truth. The admission surprised her.
"If things were different, I'd make you forget him.
And I'd let you try."
She saw the way he smiled at that, saw the sorrow in it.
"Blue," he said after a pause.
"Blue?"
"It's the paint color I have."
Isabel smiled.
"How fitting."
Later that day, as she stood in one line after another for too little food, and then as she gathered wood from the forest and carried it home, she thought about that kiss. What she thought, over and over again, was, "If only." Chapter 13. On a beautiful day in late April of 1941, Isabel lay stretched out on a woolen blanket in the field across from the house. The sweet smell of ripening hay filled her nostrils. When she closed her eyes, She could almost forget that the engines in the distance were German lorries taking soldiers and France's produce to the train station at Tours. After the disastrous winter, she appreciated how the sunshine lulled her into a drowsy state.
There you are.
Isabel sighed and sat up. Vianne wore a faded blue gingham day dress that had been grayed by harsh homemade soap. Hunger had whittled her down over the winter, sharpened her cheekbones, and deepened the hollow at the base of her throat. An old scarf turbaned her head, hiding hair that had lost its shine and curl.
This came for you.
Vianne held out a piece of paper.
It was delivered by a man.
For you, she said, as if that fact bore repeating. Isabel clambered awkwardly to her feet and snatched the paper from Vianne's grasp. On it, in scrawled handwriting, was, "The curtains are open." She reached down for her blanket and began folding it up. What did it mean? They'd never summoned her before. Something important must be happening.
Isabel, would you care to explain?
No.
It was Henri Navarre, the innkeeper's son. I didn't think you knew him.
Isabel ripped the note into tiny pieces and let it fall away.
He's a communist, you know, Vianne said in a whisper. I need to go.
Vianne grabbed her wrist.
You cannot have been sneaking out all winter to see a communist. You know what the Nazis think of them. It's dangerous to even be seen with this man.
You think I care what the Nazis think?
Isabel said, wrenching free. She ran barefooted across the field. At home, she grabbed some shoes and climbed aboard her bicycle. With an
au revoir
to a stunned-looking Vianne, Isabel was off, pedaling down the dirt road. In town, she coasted past the abandoned hat shop. Sure enough, the curtains were open, and veered into the cobblestone alley and came to a stop. She leaned her bicycle against the rough limestone wall beside her and rapped four times. It didn't occur to her until the final knock that it might be a trap. The idea, when it came, made her draw in a sharp breath and glance left and right, but it was too late now. Henri opened the door. Isabel ducked inside. The room was hazy with cigarette smoke and reeked of burnt chicory coffee. There was about the place a lingering scent of blood, sausage making. The burly man who had first grabbed her, Didier, was seated on an old hickory-backed chair. He was leaning back so far the two front chair legs were off the floor and his back grazed the wall behind him.
You shouldn't have brought a notice to my house, Henri. My sister is asking questions.
It was important we talk to you immediately.
Isabel felt a little bump of excitement. Would they finally ask her to do something more than dropping papers in letterboxes?
I am here.
Henri lit up a cigarette. She could feel him watching her as he exhaled the gray smoke and put down his match.
Have you heard of a prefect in Chartres who was arrested and tortured for being a communist?
Isabel frowned.
No.
He cut his own throat with a piece of glass rather than name anyone or confess.
Henri snubbed his cigarette out on the bottom of his shoe and saved the rest for later in his coat pocket.
He is putting a group together of people like us who want to heed de Gaulle's call. He, the one who cut his own throat, is trying to get to London to speak to de Gaulle himself. He seeks to organize a Free French movement.
He didn't die? Isabel asked.
Or cut his vocal cords?
No, they're calling it a miracle,
Didier said. Henri studied Isabel.
I have a letter, very important, that needs to be delivered to our contact in Paris. Unfortunately, I am being watched closely these days, as is Didier.
Oh, Isabel said.
I thought of you,
Didier said.
Me?
Henri reached into his pocket and withdrew a crumpled envelope.
Will you deliver this to our man in Paris? He is expecting it a week from today.
But I don't have an Ausweis.
Oui, Henri said quietly. And if you were caught?
He let that threat dangle.
Certainly no one would think badly of you if you declined. This is dangerous.
Dangerous was an understatement. There were signs posted throughout Carivaux about executions that were taking place all over the occupied zone. The Nazis were killing French citizens for the smallest of infractions. Aiding this Free French movement could get her imprisoned at the very least. Still, she believed in a free France the way her sister believed in God.
So you want me to get a pass, go to Paris, deliver a letter, and come home?
It didn't sound so perilous when put that way.
No, Henri said. We need you to stay in Paris and be our letterbox, as it were. In the coming months, there will be many such deliveries. Your father has an apartment there, oui?
Paris. It was what she'd longed for from the moment her father had exiled her. To leave Carivaux and return to Paris, and to be part of a network of people who resisted this war.
My father will not offer me a place to stay.
Convince him otherwise,
Didier said evenly, watching her, judging her.
He is not a man who is easily convinced, she said.
So you can't do it. Voila, we have our answer.
Wait,
Isabel said. Henri approached her. She saw reluctance in his eyes and knew that he wanted her to turn down this assignment. No doubt he was worried about her. She lifted her chin and looked him in the eyes.
I will do this.
You will have to lie to everyone you love and always be afraid. Can you live that way? You'll not feel safe anywhere.
Isabel laughed grimly. It was not so different from the life she'd lived since she was a little girl.
Will you watch over my sister?
She asked Henri.
Make sure she's safe?
There is a price for all our work, Henri said.
He gave her a sad look. In it was the truth they had all learned. There was no safety.
I hope you see that.
All Isabel saw was her chance to do something that mattered.
When do I leave?
As soon as you get an Ausweis, which will not be easy.
What in heaven's name is that girl thinking?
Really, a schoolyard-style note from a man? A communist? Vianne unwrapped the stringy piece of mutton that had been this week's ration and set it on the kitchen counter. Isabel had always been impetuous. A force of nature, really. A girl who liked to break rules. Countless nuns and teachers had learned that she could be neither controlled nor contained. But this was not kissing a boy on the dance floor or running away to see the circus or refusing to wear a girdle and stockings. This was wartime in an occupied country. How could Isabel still believe that her choices had no consequences? Vianne began finally chopping the mutton. She added a precious egg to the mix and stale bread, then seasoned it with salt and pepper. She was forming the mixture into patties when she heard a motorcycle putt-puttering toward the house. She went to the front door and opened it just enough to peer out. Captain Beck's head and shoulders could be seen above the stone wall as he dismounted his motorcycle. Moments later, a green military lorry pulled up behind him and parked. Three other German soldiers appeared in her yard. The men talked among themselves and then gathered at the rose-covered stone wall her great-great-grandfather had built. One of the soldiers lifted a sledgehammer and brought it down hard on the wall, which shattered. Stones broke into pieces. A skein of roses fell, their pink petals scattering across the grass. Vianne rushed out into her yard.
Herr Captain!
The sledgehammer came down again. Crack!
Madame, Beck said, looking unhappy.
It bothered Vianne that she knew him well enough to notice his state of mind.
"We have orders to tear down all the walls along this road."
As one soldier demolished the wall, two others came toward the front door, laughing at some joke between them. Without asking permission, they walked past her and went into her house.
"My condolences," Beck said, stepping over the rubble on his way to her. "I know you love the roses, and, most sorrowfully, my men will be fulfilling a requisition order from your house."
"A requisition?"
The soldiers came out of the house. One carried the oil painting that had been over the mantel, and the other had the overstuffed chair from the salon.
"That was my grandmère's favorite chair,"
Vianne said quietly.
"I'm sorry," Beck said. "I was unable to stop this."
"What in the world?"
Vianne didn't know whether to be relieved or concerned when Isabel yanked her bike over the pile of stone and leaned it against the tree. Already there was no barrier between her property and the road anymore. Isabel looked beautiful, even with her face pink from the exertion of riding her bicycle and shiny with perspiration. Glossy blonde waves framed her face. Her faded red dress clung to her body in all the right places. The soldiers stopped to stare at her. The rolled-up Aubusson rug from the living room slung between them. Beck removed his military cap. He said something to the soldiers who were carrying the rolled-up carpet, and they hurried toward the lorry.
"You've torn down our wall?"
Isabel said.
"The Sturmbannführer wants to be able to see all houses from the road. Somebody is distributing anti-German propaganda. We shall find and arrest him."
"You think harmless pieces of paper are worth all of this?" Isabel asked.
"They are far from harmless, mademoiselle. They encourage terrorism."
"Terrorism must be avoided," Isabel said, crossing her arms.
Vianne couldn't look away from Isabel. There was something going on. Her sister seemed to be drawing her emotions back, going still, like a cat preparing to pounce.
"Herr Captain,"
Isabel said after a while.
"Oui, mademoiselle."
Soldiers walked past them, carrying out the breakfast table. Isabel let them pass and then walked to the captain.
"My papa is ill."
"He is?" Vianne said. "Why don't I know this? What's wrong with him?"
Isabel ignored Vianne.
"He has asked that I come to Paris to nurse him, but..."
"He wants you to nurse him?"
Vianne said, incredulous. Beck said,
"You need a travel pass to leave, mademoiselle. You know this."
"I know this,"
Isabel seemed to barely breathe.
"I thought perhaps you would procure one for me. You are a family man. Certainly you understand how important it is to answer a father's call."
Strangely, as Isabel spoke, the captain turned slightly to look at Vianne, as if she were the one who mattered.
"I could get you a pass, oui,"
the captain said.
"For a family emergency such as this."
"I am grateful,"
Isabel said. Vianne was stunned. Did Beck not see how her sister was manipulating him? And why had he looked at Vianne when making his decision? As soon as Isabel got what she wanted, she returned to her bicycle. She took hold of the handlebars and walked it toward the barn. The rubber wheels bumped and thumped on the uneven ground. Vianne rushed after her.
"Papa's ill?"
she said when she caught up with her sister.
"Papa's fine."
"You lied? Why?"
Isabel's pause was slight but perceptible.
"I suppose there is no reason to lie. It's all out in the open now. I have been sneaking out on Friday mornings to meet Henri, and now he has asked me to go to Paris with him. He has a lovely little pied-à-terre in the Montmartre, apparently."
"Are you mad?"
"I am in love, I think. A little. Maybe."
"You are going to cross Nazi-occupied France to spend a few nights in Paris in the bed of a man whom you might love a little."
"I know," Isabel said.
It's so romantic.
You must be feverish. Perhaps you have a brain sickness of some kind.
She put her hands on her hips and made a huff of disapproval.
If love is a disease, I suppose I'm infected.
Good God!
Vian crossed her arms.
Is there anything I can say to stop this foolishness?
Isabel looked at her.
You believe me? You believe I would cross Nazi-occupied France on a lark?
This is not like running away to see the circus, Isabel.
But you believe this of me?
Of course, Vian shrugged. So foolish.
Isabel looked oddly crestfallen.
Just stay away from Beck while I'm gone. Don't trust him.
Isn't that just like you? You're worried enough to warn me, but not worried enough to stay with me. What you want is really what matters. Sophie and I can rot for all you care.
That's not true.
Isn't it? Go to Paris. Have your fun, but don't for one minute forget that you are abandoning your niece and me.
Vian crossed her arms and glanced back at the man in her yard, who was supervising the looting of her house.
With him.
Chapter 14. April 27th, 1995. The Oregon Coast.
I am trussed up like a chicken for roasting. I know these modern seat belts are a good thing, but they make me feel claustrophobic. I belong to a generation that didn't expect to be protected from every danger. I remember what it used to be like back in the days when one was required to make smart choices. We knew the risks and took them anyway. I remember driving too fast in my old Chevrolet, my foot pressed hard on the gas, smoking a cigarette and listening to Price sing "Lordy, Miss Claudie" through small black speakers while children rolled around in the back seat like bowling pins. My son is afraid that I will make a break for it, I suppose, and it is a reasonable fear. In the past month, my entire life has been turned upside down. There is a sold sign in my front yard, and I am leaving home.
It's a pretty driveway, don't you think?
My son says. It's what he does. He fills space with words, and he chooses them carefully. It is what makes him a good surgeon. Precision. Yes.
He turns into the parking lot.
Like the driveway, it is lined in flowering trees. Tiny white blossoms drop to the ground like bits of lace on a dressmaker's floor, stark against the black asphalt. I fumble with my seatbelt as we park. My hands do not obey my will these days. It frustrates me so much that I curse out loud.
I'll do that, my son says, reaching sideways to unhook my seatbelt. He is out of the automobile and at my door before I have even retrieved my handbag. The door opens. He takes me by the hand and helps me out of the car. In the short distance between the parking lot and the entrance, I have to stop twice to catch my breath.
The trees are so pretty this time of year, he says as we walk together across the parking lot.
Yes. They are flowering plum trees, gorgeous and pink, but I think suddenly of chestnut trees in bloom along the Champs-Élysées. My son tightens his hold on my hand. It is a reminder that he understands the pain of leaving a home that has been my sanctuary for nearly 50 years. But now it is time to look ahead, not behind. To the Ocean Crest Retirement Community and Nursing Home. To be fair, it doesn't look like a bad place. A little industrial, maybe, with its rigidly upright windows and
perfectly maintained patch of grass out front, and the American flag flying above the door. It is a long, low building, built in the 70s, I'd guess, back when just about everything was ugly. There are two wings that reach out from a central courtyard, where I imagine old people sit in wheelchairs with their faces turned to the sun, waiting. Thank God I am not housed in the east side of the building, the nursing home wing. Not yet, anyway. I can still manage my own life, thank you very much, and my own apartment. Julian opens the door for me, and I go inside. The first thing I see is a large reception area decorated to look like the hospitality desk of a seaside hotel, complete with a fishing net full of shells hung on the wall. I imagine that at Christmas they hang ornaments from the netting and stockings from the edge of the desk. There are probably sparkly ho-ho-ho signs tacked up to the wall on the day after Thanksgiving.
Come on, Mom.
Oh, right. Mustn't dawdle. The place smells of what? Tapioca pudding and chicken noodle soup. Soft foods. Somehow I keep going. If there's one thing I never do, it's stop.
Here we are, my son says, opening the door to room 317A.
It's nice, honestly. A small, one-bedroom apartment. The kitchen is tucked into the corner by the door, and from it one can look out over a formica counter and see a dining table with four chairs and the living room, where a coffee table and sofa and two chairs are gathered around a gas fireplace. The TV in the corner is brand new, with a built-in VCR player. Someone, my son probably, has stacked a bunch of my favorite movies in the bookcase. Jean de Florette, Breathless, Gone with the Wind. I see my things. An afghan I knitted thrown over the sofa's back. My books in the bookcase. In the bedroom, which is of a fine size, the nightstand on my side of the bed is lined with prescription pill containers, a little jungle of plastic orange cylinders. My side of the bed. It's funny, but some things don't change after the death of a spouse, and that's one of them. The left side of the bed is mine, even though I'm alone in it. At the foot of the bed is my trunk, just as I have requested.
You could still change your mind, he says quietly. Come home with me.
We've talked about this, Julian. Your life is too busy. You needn't worry about me 24/7.
Do you think I will worry less when you are here?
I look at him, loving this child of mine and knowing my death will devastate him. I don't want him to watch me die by degrees. I don't want that for his daughters either. I know what it is like. Some images, once seen, can never be forgotten. I want them to remember me as I am, not as I will be when the cancer has had its way. He leads me into the small living room and gets me settled on the couch. While I wait, he pours us some wine and then sits beside me. I am thinking of how it will feel when he leaves, and I'm sure the same thought occupies his mind. With a sigh, he reaches into his briefcase and pulls out a stack of envelopes. The sigh is in place of words, a breath of transition. In it, I hear that moment where I go from one life to another. In this new, pared-down version of my life, I am to be cared for by my son instead of vice versa. It's not really comfortable for either of us.
I've paid this month's bills. These are things I don't know what to do with. Junk mostly, I think. I take the stack of letters from him and shuffle through them. A personalized letter from the Special Olympics Committee. A free estimate awning offer. A notice from my dentist that it has been 6 months since my last appointment. A letter from Paris. There are red markings on it, as if the post office has shuffled it around from place to place or delivered it incorrectly. Mom? Julian says. He is so observant. He misses nothing.
What is that?
When he reaches for the envelope, I mean to hold on to it, keep it from him, but my fingers don't obey my will. My heartbeat is going all which away. Julian opens the envelope, extracts an écru card. An invitation.
It's in French, he says. Something about the Croix de Guerre. So it's about World War II? Is this for Dad?
Of course. Men always think war is all about them.
And there's something handwritten in the corner. What is it?
Guerre. The word expands around me, unfolds its black crow wings, becoming so big I cannot look away. Against my will, I take up the invitation. It is to a passeurs' reunion in Paris. They want me to attend. How can I possibly go without remembering all of it? The terrible things I have done. The secret I kept. The man I killed. And the one I should have.
Mom, what's a passeur?
I can hardly find enough voice to say. It's someone who helped people. In the war.
Chapter 15. Asking yourself a question, that's how resistance begins. And then ask that very question to someone else. Remco Campert. May 1941, France. On the Monday Isabel left for Paris, Vianne kept busy. She washed clothes and hung them out to dry. She weeded her garden and gathered a few early ripening vegetables. At the end of a long day, she treated herself to a bath and washed her hair. She was drying it with a towel when she heard a knock at the door. Startled by an unexpected guest, she buttoned her bodice as she went to the door. Water dripped onto her shoulders. When she opened the door, she found Captain Beck standing there, dressed in his field uniform, dust peppering his face.
"Herr Captain," she said, pushing the wet hair away from her face.
"Madame," he said. "A colleague and I went fishing today. I have brought you what we caught."
"Fresh fish? How lovely. I will fry it up for you."
"For us, madame. You and me and Sophie."
Vianne couldn't look away from either Beck or the fish in his hands. She knew without a doubt that Isabel wouldn't accept this gift, just as she knew that her friends and neighbors would claim to turn it down. Food. From the enemy. It was a matter of pride to turn it down. Everyone knew that.
"I have neither stolen nor demanded it. No Frenchman has more of a right to it than I. There can be no dishonor in your taking it."
He was right. This was a fish from local waters. He had not confiscated it. Even as she reached for the fish, she felt the weight of rationalization settle heavily upon her.
"You rarely do us the honor of eating with us."
"It is different now," he said, "with your sister away."
Vianne backed into the house to allow him entry. As always, he removed his hat as soon as he stepped inside and clomped across the wooden floor to his room. Vianne didn't notice until she heard the click shut of his door that she was still standing there, holding a dead fish wrapped in a recent edition of the Pariser Zeitung, the German newspaper printed in Paris. She returned to the kitchen. When she laid the paper-wrapped fish out on the butcher block, she saw that he'd already cleaned the fish, even going so far as to shave off the scales. She lit the gas stove and put a cast-iron pan over the heat, adding a precious spoonful of oil to the pan. While cubes of potato browned and onion caramelized, she seasoned the fish with salt and pepper and set it aside. In no time, tantalizing aromas filled the house, and Sophie came running into the kitchen, skidding to a stop in the empty space where the breakfast table used to be.
"Fish,"
she said with reverence. Vian used her spoon to create a well within the vegetables and put the fish in the middle to fry. Tiny bits of grease popped up. The skin sizzled and turned crisp. At the very end, she placed a few preserved lemons in the pan, watching them melt over everything.
"Go tell Captain Beck that supper is ready. He is eating with us? Tante Isabel would have something to say about that. Before she left, she told me never to look him in the eye and to try not to be in the same room with him."
Vian sighed. The ghost of her sister lingered.
"He brought us the fish, Sophie, and he lives here." "Oui, maman, I know that still. She said, go call the captain for supper. Isabel is gone, and with her, her extreme worries. Now go."
Vian returned to the stove. Moments later, she carried out a heavy ceramic tray bearing the fried fish surrounded by the pan-roasted vegetables and preserved lemons, all of it enhanced with fresh parsley. The tangy lemony sauce in the bottom of the pan, swimming with crusty brown bits, could have benefited from butter, but still it smelled heavenly. She carried it into the dining room and found Sophie already seated, with Captain Beck beside her. In Antoine's chair, Vian missed a step. Beck rose politely and moved quickly to pull out her chair. She paused only slightly as he took the platter from her.
"This looks most becoming," he said in a hearty voice.
Once again, his French was not quite right. Vian sat down and scooted into her place at the table. Before she could think of what to say, Beck was pouring her wine.
"A lovely 37 Montrachet," he said.
Vian knew what Isabel would say to that. Beck sat across from her. Sophie sat to her left. She was talking about something that had happened at school today. When she paused, Beck said something about fishing, and Sophie laughed. And Vian felt Isabel's absence as keenly as she'd previously felt her presence.
"Stay away from Beck."
Vian heard the warning as clearly as if it had been spoken aloud beside her. She knew that in this one thing her sister was right. Vian couldn't forget the list after all, and the firings, or the sight of Beck seated at his desk with crates of food at his feet and a painting of the Führer behind him.
"My wife quite despaired of my skill with Annette after that," he was saying, smiling.
Sophie laughed.
"My papa fell into the river one time when we were fishing, remember, Maman? He said the fish was so big it pulled him in, right, Maman?"
Vian blinked slowly. It took her a moment to notice that the conversation had circled back to include her. It felt odd, to say the least. In all their past meals with Beck at the table, conversation had been rare. Who could speak surrounded by Isabel's obvious anger?
"It is different now, with your sister away."
Vian understood what he meant. The tension in the house, at this table, was gone now. What other changes would her absence bring?
"Stay away from Beck."
How was Vian to do that? And when was the last time she'd eaten a meal this good, or heard Sophie laugh? The Gare de Lyon was full of German soldiers when Isabel disembarked from the train carriage. She wrestled her bicycle out with her. It wasn't easy with her valise banging into her thighs the whole time, and impatient Parisians shoving at her. She had dreamed of coming back here for months. In her dreams, Paris was Paris, untouched by the war. But on this Monday afternoon, after a long day's travel,